Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. I have been a veteran consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, and thought leader bridging Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and Madison Avenue for a very long time. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. And I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Michael Solomon. And Michael co-founded Brickwall Management back in the mid-90s, which is an artist management and entertainment consulting firm that he started with his childhood friend, Rishon Bloomberg. Brickwall's diverse client roster includes artists such as John Mayer, Citizen Cope, Martin Sexton, Cherry Poppandaddies, Vanessa Carlton, The Clark, a few of the artists. In 2012, Michael 10X Management, deep knowledge of talent management into the tech industry. 10X represents some of the world's most sought-after independent developers, designers, and tech professionals. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Michael, I always like to start these shows with a core question, which is, having a trusted advisor is so important. Would you be willing to share with our listeners who some of your mentors have been along the way? Have you mentored others over the years as well?
Absolutely. It's an interesting question because I view artists and talent management very much as being a mentor for people. But to go back to the first half of your question, I would say I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of informal mentors over the years and then some people who have been there throughout the years. I would definitely put my father among them. He is a big fan of wisdom and is always willing to impart some on me. Usually people have to get online to get his wisdom, but I get to the front pretty quickly. Also, Barbara Carr, who manages Bruce Springsteen, has been a tremendous and valuable asset in helping me get into the music industry and figuring out how to navigate the shall we say, challenging hallways of it. My partner, Rishon, it's a very balanced relationship between us, but I think that, you know, we switch back and forth between playing those roles for each other as the circumstance dictates.
Yes. And, of course, it's so important to have good collaborators.
Yes. And then in the other direction, you know, I think I've mentored quite a few people over the years, some of them employees, some of them friends, some of them the children of friends, and certainly played that role quite a bit with our clients.
Absolutely. I would expect that. But kind of historically starting out, Michael, I understand you started out in music touring with Bruce Springsteen. Could you share a little bit about what that was like?
Heaven. I was 19 when I started doing that. Maybe I was 20 or 21, but it was my first real job in the music industry, and I got to travel throughout Europe and stay in the most beautiful hotels in the world, travel on private planes, see fans like no other. I've never seen fans like that. Other than going to Springsteen shows in Europe, they are just truly unbelievable. So it was a pretty great way to start. And probably more telling as it relates to my career was I got to see the wonderful relationship between managers and an artist that was built on trust and respect and history and loyalty.
Somebody like Springsteen kept his management for decades.
Yep. Exactly.
Unlike others that we know who don't.
And that's correct.
That's its own inherent set of challenges. But what gave you, so that was going to lead my next question, Michael, which is what gave you the impetus to start your own talent management company?
Right after the Springsteen tour, I took a job at Epic Records and Sony Music International and rapidly saw that, at least in a large corporate environment, there was not a whole lot of room for my explosive entrepreneurial side, for better or for worse, it's hard to put it away. So, the people in my life suggested that if there was ever a time to go out and try to make go of it when you're 25 years old is a good time. It's pre-wife, pre-children, and Roshan and I just decided to give it a shot. It's actually, we're about 20 days away from our 20th anniversary of that faithful leap of faith.
That's significant. Congratulations. That's quite
Thank
a milestone.
You.
And, you know, I know your reputation in the industry, and you've got a stellar one. And it's critical. That's really all you've got in the business. So maybe you could talk about, briefly, some of the experience you've – I know it's difficult sometimes to work with a broad spectrum of clients and artists in particular. Is there any one experience as an example of being an artist manager that jumps out for better or worse?
I think, you know, I think the one that the listeners would probably most relate to is the 4 years we spent working, co-managing John Mayer with Michael McDonald. It was, you know, our definitely our biggest commercial success in music, and a really incredible career ascension from, you know, the very beginnings of a fan base to, by the time we were done, 8 million albums and multiple Grammys and arena tours. And it was just 4 years from beginning to that. And it was a really interesting learning experience, because when you have to scale something that quickly and it actually relates to technology, you really have to be thinking on your toes, and you have to surround yourself with the right people very quickly.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're going to jump around a bit during our conversation, but it reminds me of our mutual friend Scott Welch and his experience with Alanis Morissette. Very similar in terms
Absolutely.
Of that trajectory of taking somebody from, you know, from cradle to explosion in a very short
period
of
time. Yeah, I mean, that was a meteor. That was a literally unprecedented meteor high. I think that's the largest selling debut album for a female artist in history.
To be sure. And so that's the explosion experience that you've had. Of course, you and I share the music industry implosion that preceded and perhaps catalyzed your movement into the tech space.
Yeah, I'd say that the thing about the music industry implosion, as you called it, and it's a good term for it, was the writing was really on the wall, and the people who really were in a position to make radical change just buried their heads in the sand.
Yes.
And by the way, I don't know that there was a radical move that would have completely altered the course, other than perhaps licensing to Napster. But it was just watching a very slow train wreck. I always joke with people when I talk about the book publishing industry,
yeah.
And for that matter, the magazine publishing industry, that they were driving in a car, and they got to watch the car in front of them, which was the music industry, go right off a cliff and then blow up right in front of their eyes. And they
well,
were
don't forget,
the same...
film industry had the same opportunity.
Yes. I view them a little bit further behind, and television. And
yeah.
And the publishing industry they didn't put their foot on the brake. They didn't do anything. Just kept going right after us.
No, I think you know this, Michael. Forgive me if we've already had this conversation, but during my tenure at Apple, driving the music, entertainment, and publishing vertical when I was there, this is going back almost 20 years ago now, and we saw that coming. And Apple tried to be at the forefront of even starting to put some plans in place well before iTunes at that point. We saw exactly what was going to happen, and we wanted to be at the front end of the train to drive the change. Similarly, when I left Apple... at Napster, I was one of the early advisors there. And to your point, the labels were offered. In fact, it's public knowledge, $1 billion to allow Napster to demonstrate to them how they could monetize the 70 million users 15 years ago. And I do think that might have altered the trajectory of what happened to the record business. We have to call it the record business because the music industry itself is thriving in many ways, especially the live part of it. But that's what happened to the record labels.
Yes, although I would, as my technology industry knowledge and excitement for virtual reality grows, I do have grave concerns for the live music, the live entertainment business.
Yes, I share that with you in terms of all the streaming that's happening and live concerts. In fact, that's another area I've been pretty heavily involved with here over the last 5 years. So I'm with you on that. Fellow visionaries that have good crystal balls are hard to come by.
Well, and particularly with the virtual reality technology that's coming and the experiences you'll be able to have.
Augmented reality and such as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of stuff on the horizon in that direction, so I share that vision with you. Now, let's talk about this transition, Michael, from representing rock stars to representing tech rock stars. That's two different industries, and it's something of a big leap. How did you and Rashawn decide this was the right move and the right time for you to segue into that direction? Start 10X.
So as we were seeing the decimation of the music industry, we sort of experimenting with a variety of ideas, and over the course of doing that, we did two different iOS projects. One was a hybrid between a digital box set and a fan club that would be allow you to purchase music and experience via the App Store. And it was both as a platform, and the other is a setlist based app that we did one for Springsteen, Fish, and Dave Matthews, where hardcore fans can find out anything they want to know about setlist statistics and sequences. And in both of those instances, we partnered with developers who we met through our various networking efforts, and rapidly discovered that they were very similar to musicians in that they were very good at what they did. In one instance, and not as good in the other instance, but they weren't interested or good at doing the business side of the transaction at all. And that when there was a problem, there was no intermediary to help resolve the problem.
Right.
And we kept saying, we wish this guy had a manager so we could, you know, when the one guy disappeared, we could find him, or at least have some recourse. And that was when the light bulb moment happened. We decided we wanted to try it, and we networked our way. I met the person who's now our third co-founder, Altai Gavench, through a Musicians on Call volunteer. They had been in a band together at Harvard, and he told me that Altai was a professional musician, but also he supported himself coding. So I thought that sounds like somebody who's going to understand this sort of wacky, untraditional idea. And sure enough,
absolutely,
he did. And we started right away, and it went very, very well. And a couple months later, he called and he said, I don't want to be your client. I want to be your partner, and all my friends want in. And this is a huge problem solver for people who do what we do, and let's do this for real. And that was the beginning.
Yeah, and what's the inspiration behind the name 10X, Michael?
I have to give credit to Altai for that. The notion of a 10X programmer, and we're extending this far beyond programmers at this point, is a person who's so good at what they do, they can create 10 times more value than the average person. There's lots of ways that this manifests itself, but ultimately it comes from the idea of someone who's got a level of expertise and mastery that is that good and that valuable.
Right. And are there certain qualities that you look for that find somebody capable of hitting 10X?
Yeah, I mean, our vetting process and our requirements are, you know, not just finding people who have the technical chops, because I think that there are not so many people who are 10Xers purely from their technical prowess, although those do exist as well, but also people who have an understanding of communication, problem solving, customer relations, and really understanding that they're not doing a job to solve a software problem. They're part of a larger organism, and that organism is trying to do something, and they're working on a software or hardware or data problem for this entity. And they need to keep the big picture in mind, not just the little task that was put in front of them or big task.
Right, exactly. And, you know, tell us about some of the services you provide your clients with.
Sure. So the clients, which is the people who we represent, the talent, as the same way we would refer to a musician as a client.
Right.
Come to us having little or no interest in handling the finding of their work, the negotiating of their rates, the contract portion, the invoice portion and the follow-up portion, and they really are very happy to hand those things over to us. We work with all of our clients exclusively, and they find tremendous value in that. And then it goes a step further for those who wish to use us this way, where we get into much more longer-term strategy, continuing education, recommending the right kinds of coaches for the things they want to achieve. So we've really only begun to scratch the surface of what we hope to do in helping our clients who are already 10Xers become even greater, because there's no end to optimizing most things.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And then on the other side, in terms of the customers, the people who hire these people, what we offer them is a very fast solution to their problem. So as you know, the talent shortage for technology professionals is tremendous. And if you're a startup or a Fortune 100 company and you need a person to solve your problem, a technology person, your search time for getting that person is on average between 3 and 8 months right now. And that's an awfully long time to not get whatever problem solved. So we ultimately create a pipeline where you can come to us and within, you know, hours or at the very most a couple of days, have a profile in front of you for somebody who meets the requirements that you're looking for and is available in the time frame that you need them. They're not necessarily in your city. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not.
Right.
But they're available and they're pre-vetted and you can be up and running in a matter of days. And that's a big value proposition. And then we're also talking about people who are highly, highly skilled at what they do. These are core contributors to major languages. We've got a guy who's one of the contributors to Bitcoin and, you know, the person who briefed the Treasury Secretary about what Bitcoin is. We've got people who wrote very popular languages and frameworks. For instance, the guy who oversaw the team at Apple of 35 people that did the user experience for iCloud is one of our project manager clients. So these are people who are very seasoned, very experienced, and you know, more or less available on demand.
Yeah, this is amazing. It's kind of like the Navy SEALs or a SWAT team, you know, that you've assembled.
Exactly.
And they're
not cheap, but compared to sitting around and not getting the work done that you need done, they actually are very valuable. And also they work quickly because they know what they're doing. So they end up, when you look at the end of the project, you end up often saving money. I mean, we just had a situation which is a slightly different use case where a pretty large startup hired one of our guys to do a Ruby on Rails job. Along the way, there was a very important data science job that nobody could figure out. Our Ruby client who was there said, oh, let me take a whack at it. He solved it, and the solution to the problem literally changed the valuation of the company for their imminent fundraising round by a very large factor.
That's a definite testimonial. That's phenomenal.
Yes.
And I'm not surprised to hear that. These are opportunity costs that companies have if they don't get the right people on board fast enough. So
exactly.
What's worth it is kind of priceless. And in the case of what you just discussed, it is tangible, but, you know, we're saying the same thing. And, of course, to your point about there being a shortage of good talent happening in the space right now, what's the most incredible strategy you've seen a company employ in order to retain talent?
It's interesting because I see a lot of companies, and again, we're dealing with, our client base are freelance, our contractors, but, we're seeing companies throw money at some problems. We're seeing companies do also very the opposite of that. As you know, there's this huge class action suit that was settled this year for companies that colluded to not pay their engineers well. As it turns out, that wasn't exactly what they were colluding to do. They were colluding not to rate each other's engineers.
Yes, I'm well aware of that.
I think that there's a bit of a disconnect between the supply and the demand equation in the tech space right now, and it's starting to change. But ultimately, companies who really want to have the top talent are going to have to come up with the top money. You know, if you look at what a company pays its lawyers, I don't see why they're not paying their top tech talent in the same spectrum, because a good lawyer is a wonderful thing, but there are a lot of them. There are not a lot of good engineers.
Yeah, and I have a feeling when you describe yourself as an equalizer, Michael, this is kind of the direction of what you mean by that, right?
Yes, and I should rephrase. There are a lot of good engineers. There are not a lot of great engineers.
There we go, good to great. But this notion of you being an equalizer, is this part of your dogma that you evangelize out there, I'm imagining.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, we really view our company as having a double bottom line. So while we are paid in the same way that a manager in the music industry is paid, where we earn a percentage of our clients' revenue, they're still a very important component to the customer who hires them. So we take the relationship we have with the people who hire our clients every bit as seriously as the relationship with the tech talent, because
yes,
that's the bread and butter, and they have to be happy or they won't come back and they won't send other people to us.
And they won't make
so,
yeah.
Right. So we need to have a process that is incredibly smooth, very streamlined, and very, very customer service and white glove focused, because we are dealing with very high-end people. This, I don't want to say it's a luxury product, but you want the best of the best. You go buy a Porsche or a Mercedes, you're going to expect a certain experience in the dealership.
To be sure, yeah. And I know how seriously you take that. I'm curious as well, when your clients, the programmers, the high-end programmers, are out on assignment, do the term lengths vary? Can they go on for a couple years, or is it typically just a couple months, or what's been your experience about that?
They do vary. We haven't had anything go on for a couple of years. Actually, I'm gonna think about that for a second. We certainly have engagements that are longer than a year. eBay came to us for some people, and they started out as 3-month contracts, but then they loved them and they kept renewing them over and over. And by the time it was done, I think it was over a year and a half or a year and 3/4. There have been a few like that. We've definitely had a few ongoing engagements. I'd say a typical engagement is a couple months up to 6-9 months. But we're happy to do longer-term arrangements when it's the right fit for everybody. Our job is to make that fit work.
I'd imagine so. And have you lost anyone to being hired away from 10X?
Yes. Yes, it does happen. It doesn't happen frequently because our people are not freelancing because they don't have access to full-time jobs. These are people who are literally getting 5 job offers a day. They like freelancing because they like a new challenge. They would much rather get a new gig every 3-6 months and get to sink their teeth into a new problem than go inside and have a big problem that they solve, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and they get bored.
Calling your own shots as a consultant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a lifestyle choice because we've got, you know, an American guy who lives in Thailand and scuba dives quite a bit, and he codes at night, and we've got other people who take off part of the summer to spend with their children, and other people who travel the world, and some who go snowboarding, and some who spend 3 days a week on their startups, and whatever it is, it's really the perfect way to work. And, you know, if truth be told, we hope to the trend that's already begun of this movement toward a freelance economy move further along than it has. It's really, it's the best of all worlds, and it can really replace full-time employment for most positions.
Well, once again, we share that crystal ball real estate. I've been out on my own now for close to 2 decades with that mindset. And my neighbor is a UI programmer, a woman who's top-notch. In fact, I probably ought to connect you guys. And she has recently come to that same conclusion and is thriving because she's that good. She's probably a 10Xer.
Yeah, but you have to be great. At this moment in time, you have to be great to command these kinds of things. Like, you know, a lot of companies want people on site, and we do that whenever we can. We're not opposed to that. But sometimes we'll present a company with somebody who they have to have, and they're willing to let them work remotely because this is one of the very few people in the world that might solve the problem that they have.
Well, I agree. And again, we've already talked about what the value of that is. One last question about 10X, and then I want us to move on to musicians on call, Michael. I've got to say, I'm kind of surprised that there isn't, maybe there are some so-called competitors in quotes to 10X, maybe not that manage the caliber you do. But how do you see this landscape evolving in the mid to long term? We've kind of just started to discuss that, the freelance economy.
I can only assume, because this is working and we've certainly been blessed with tons of press, that there are real competitors coming. I'm not particularly concerned about it because I think there's a massive marketplace here. And to a degree, if we live up to our value proposition and really have the best of the best, people are going to continue to come to us. I hope this doesn't turn into a price war where somebody, we charge 15% from our clients and somebody else comes along and says, oh, we'll do the same thing for 10%. And somebody else comes along and says, we'll do it for 5%. And then we're back on the race to zero. I'd like to think our offering will be sufficient that won't be a factor for us. But the more people that really understand the value of the tech talent, the more the positions are going to be filled, because a lot of the problem with what's happened up until now is people view these guys and women as commodities, and
yeah,
they're not. And
yeah,
that's the reason we have a waiting list that's somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people who want to be represented by us, because we recognize that this is the talent. These are the people who are building the things that make the world go. And whether you're the person who wrote the code for Instagram or Pinterest or Facebook, like, you're creating such tremendous value for these companies. And the companies, I hope, will continue to will begin to treat people that way, as the rock stars that they are.
I certainly hope so. And you're doing such a great job. I mean, and the press coverage is just astounding. I don't even know how many pages that New Yorker magazine article was in November. I want to make sure to reference it for our listeners. Michael and 10X were featured in a beautiful piece in the New Yorker called The Programmer's Price. Want to hire a coding superstar? Call the agent. This is November 24th, 2014, issue of the New Yorker, and I highly recommend, if you want to learn more about Michael on the 10X side of his work, that you check out that article online.
Thank you for that. It was a pretty amazing experience,
I'll say.
I crossed that off the bucket list.
Well, no kidding. Is there anything you want to embellish about that experience for a minute?
The truth is we were blessed more or less from the day we opened our door to amazing coverage of this. I think the combination of Altai being a programmer and a Silicon Valley technologist who had been through Y Combinator twice and really had the cred on that side, and then us coming in with the music background, made for a very fun and easy story to tell. And, it was, for the first couple of years, it was sort of story after story in places that we just couldn't believe were coming to us. And then the call from the New Yorker, they said they were doing a technology issue. I thought this was about, maybe getting a quote from us to include in some story they were working on. And it wasn't until, I think, the second meeting with Lizzie where it became clear that this was a 7-page story on us. I feel very fortunate. There's not a whole lot of people that get to have that experience. And also, I mean, I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I've always known and read the publication, but I don't think I quite realize the cachet it has across the board. I mean, I've been fortunate enough, largely through Musicians on Call and other things I've done, to be exposed on a variety of press platforms over the years. But nothing, including things like the New York Times, got the response from people who knew me like this.
Yeah, yeah. As you said, it's definitely a bucket list item. It's the equivalent of someone like myself being on the cover of Fast Company or something, you know, out here in Silicon Valley. So, touche and well-deserved. That was a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Now, Michael, let's shift gears and talk about Musicians on Call, which you've referenced a couple times in passing during our chat so far. I think it was 1999 that you were the inspiration for Musicians on Call, which, if listeners are not aware of it, is a nonprofit organization that brings live music to the bedside of patients in healthcare facilities, brings the artist to the bedside of patients. And since its inception, volunteer musicians have performed for more than 250,000 people. So let's talk about Musicians on Call for a few minutes, Michael, arguably one of your favorite topics. How did it start? Tell us about that, and then how can listeners support you?
Sure. I'll give you the full rundown. I actually just want to say I think that we're now up to where this year where I think we're going to cross 500,000 people that we're going
to
serve.
Oh, my goodness. I stand corrected.
Yeah.
Humbly so.
So it goes back to the Springsteen tour time. I was dating a woman who passed away from a rare kind of cancer called sarcoma. And we set up a foundation, her parents and I set up a foundation, along with a bunch of her friends and her sister. I should actually give everybody credit, the appropriate credit, to fight that disease. And at some point, her mother, Barbara, arranged for Wynton Marsalis to play at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is where she had been treated. And the experience of just seeing how the patients reacted to music was pretty powerful. That was that performance was him in a recreation room with 50 or 100 people. It was a notable day. And then I thought, well, there's no reason I can't do this. I manage musicians. I can bring them in. So my longtime friend Vivek Tiwari and I decided we would start doing that. He had lost his mother to cancer very recently before that. And we started bringing some musicians, and the first time we did it, after the performance in the rec room, there was a staff member who said, would you be willing to bring the musician to a couple of rooms? There were people who were too sick to get out here who really wanted to hear it. And that experience that night was magical and powerful and life-altering, and we literally went home and wrote a business plan that night for what would become a nonprofit organization. And we launched it with money raised from Front Row Bruce Springsteen tickets that we auctioned on VH1.com.
Right.
And it's been running ever since. It's now operating in about 15 cities with more on the horizon in the short run. And the answer about how to support it is going to musiciansoncall.org. I definitely encourage people to watch a couple of videos there to really get a sense of what the program is. It's really a very powerful thing. It's very easy to picture a musician standing in a hospital room and playing for a patient, but it's actually so much more than what you can see or even what you can hear when you're there and it's happening. It's a very powerful transportive experience.
You can't really describe.
Exactly.
And what are your aspirations for it over time? I know you're a man of big aspirations, Michael, and you tend to make
them. Yeah. We're on a growth trajectory right now that'll see a lot of expansion into other markets in the United States. And there's one international expansion idea that's being discussed. I'd really like to see the organization grow. I mean, our vision from the very beginning is that by the time I die in 100 or 50 years, that when somebody walks into a hospital anywhere in the world, if they don't have music, the response from the patient or the family would be like, what do you mean you don't have music here? That's kind of the goal. And I think that, you know, the trends of integrated medicine and the understanding of the meditation and music and pet therapy and aromatherapy and all of these other artistic disciplines in the playing a role in healing is definitely coming of age. So, I think we're on a good track to do that. I'd love to be the provider that does it in mass, but ultimately, when you're in the nonprofit world, it's more about getting the people served than it is about whether it's our brand that does it.
Well, you have a heart of gold, Michael, and no doubt this is a critical part of your legacy, and that leads me to my final question for our time together tonight. That is, What do you view as your legacy? I mean, Musicians on Call is such a big project. Is there anything else we've not talked about in terms of what comes next behind that? Is there another project or collaboration you're incubating that you've not yet started?
Sure, I can actually answer that. I'd say my biggest legacy are named Rainin and Lucy. Those are my kids. I'd like to think they'll be my biggest legacy. You know, 10X has a second component in addition to what we're doing, which is helping our clients accelerate the startup that they work on the sides. And we've just started doing one project and have a second one that's coming up. And I'm excited about that because it really gets me to exercise those entrepreneurial muscles. And I really do like the early stages. On the nonprofit side, we created a children's film a couple of years ago about child sex abuse to educate children about what's appropriate and what's not. And that's on, it's on YouTube. It's called My Body Belongs to Me. We haven't done too much with that. I'd like to do more with that. It's a really upsetting topic. I happen not to have any personal experiences, but when I learned as a parent that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys in this country across demographics are sexually abused, I thought this is something that really needs some attention. So I don't think I'm done with that particular area yet.
No, I'm sure not. But again, it really, you know, reinforces your, you know, the well-roundedness of Michael Solomon in terms of really having your head on straight and looking at creating a powerful legacy and what can you do and actually taking action and putting things into practice.
Thank you for saying that.
And they're not small-scale things. They're big-scale things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like it. It really is very fulfilling. I definitely,
yeah, well,
you know,
I'm really
I also
quite
see
impressed,
a lot
Michael.
More, a lot more education in the latter part of my life, not traditional university style education, but personal growth is something I also want to spend some time on.
Well, that tends to be my passion. So there's more for us to discuss for sure offline. But I really want to thank you. Your time is very valuable, and I so appreciate you making the time to join us tonight. So thanks
Thank
again.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. And as usual, I do want to thank our show producer, Jessica Mastors, and our wonderful listeners who join us here each week. So we'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.